Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Venice with the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines ongoing Israeli-Palestinian violence and the prospects for new peace negotiations. Michael Ratner, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who looks at the lasting impact of the five-week post-election dispute, which revealed major flaws in the nation's electoral system. And Robert Perry, award-winning investigative journalist, who assesses the career of General Colin Powell, President-elect Bush's nominee, to become the next Secretary of State. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
More than a year after voting for independence, East Timor finds itself at a critical crossroad. In a growing economic dispute with neighboring Australia, East Timor officials are fighting over the control of oil reserves in the Indian Ocean's Timor Gap, halfway between the two countries. The Timor Gap has for several decades been an object of Australia's desire for exploiting oil resources. In 1989, Australia cut a deal with then-Indonesian dictator Suharto, who occupied East Timor since 1975, and agreed to split oil royalties on a 50-50 basis. Now the United Nations is pushing for a new agreement over the Timor Gap that will grant East Timor 90% of the oil revenue. Currently, there are three known oil and gas deposits in the Timor Gap that are worth an estimated $17 billion at current oil prices. A new treaty must be signed before East Timor is granted full independence in 2001. In early October, Peter Galbraith, a UN official, stated that East Timor had clear entitlement to more oil dollars from the oil fields in the Timor Gap. Yet Australia's Conservative Prime Minister Peter Howard is reluctant to give up the oil revenue, even though the nation has oil fields that are four times as large as those found in the Timor Gap. After ignoring the United Nations for years, right-wing activists, including organizations loyal to the theology of the Roman Catholic Church, are mobilizing to stop international agreements on family planning, women's rights, and gay rights. In a recent alert sent out to conservative activists, the Catholic Family and Human Rights Institute claimed credit for watering down the report coming out of the Beijing Plus Five conference earlier this year. At the meeting convened to update UN policy on women's rights, social conservatives stripped any mention of gay rights in the conference document. Outnumbered at UN conferences by progressives and women's rights advocates, the conservatives simply need to prevent international consensus. This can be done by knitting a small coalition of a dozen nations that are sympathetic to the restrictive views of the Catholic Church and fundamentalist Christians. Charlotte Bunch of the Center for Women's Global Leadership insists that the political task ahead is to actively lobby governments who have already signed UN treaties on family planning and women's rights to make sure these commitments are carried out despite opposition from organized right-wing forces. As a union healthcare worker, Julie Daniels earns a decent salary and benefits. But in pricey Stamford, Connecticut, her $28,000 salary doesn't go far enough to pay the rent. In fact, she is forced to live with her three children in a homeless shelter. According to the news magazine In These Times, Daniels is the new face of a growing housing crisis, where the working poor find it nearly impossible to secure affordable apartments. Despite the current economic boom across America, over 6 million families cannot afford shelter. Housing advocates blame initiatives by the Clinton administration for the loss of over 1.5 million low-income housing units. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has aggressively pushed its Hope 6 program that has directly led to the demolition of 80,000 public housing units. Even with a large government surplus, activists are unable to convince HUD or the Republican-led Congress to spend money to build new affordable apartments. Currently, the Federal Housing Administration has a $5 billion surplus, as efforts in Congress to create up to 200,000 new affordable units remain stalled. One bright spot is the willingness of the National AFL-CIO to expand its commitment to affordable housing by doubling the size of its housing investment trust. Nationally, housing advocates are pushing for a measure sponsored by Massachusetts Senator John Kerry to create a federal housing trust fund that over 5 years could inject $20 billion into affordable housing development. The key is to get nonprofit housing groups to forcibly lobby Congress for the fund, something that many nonprofit developers have been unwilling to do in recent years. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Curry.
After 3 months of violence and more than 330 Palestinians killed in the latest intifada or uprising, representatives of Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat are set to renew peace talks. Expectations for the dialogue are low as the conflict continues and Palestinian officials charge the Israeli military with carrying out at least 10 recent assassination attempts against leaders of Arafat's Fatah party. The negotiations also took place against a backdrop of political uncertainty as Israel prepares for elections in February after Barak resigned his post as prime minister. Barak, who is fighting for his political life, will likely face the conservative Likud party's Ariel Sharon after former prime minister Benjamin Netanyahu bowed out of the race when he failed to win support for new parliamentary elections. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Phyllis Bennis, author and fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the prospects for success in the next round of Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations.
There's been somewhere in the area of 330 Palestinian dead, something in the area of 38 Israeli dead. It means it's 90% of the deaths are of Palestinians, only 10% are of Israelis, which points to the disproportionate use of force on one side. But I think what's as important or more important than that horrifying statistic is the disproportionate nature of the legitimacy of the two sides. And by that I mean that I don't think it's sufficient for us to decry the level of violence. Military occupation is an inherently violent institution. And while the violence of the last several weeks has indeed been disproportionate and horrifyingly severe, far more than at any time probably since 1967, in terms of the number of Palestinians killed and with grave life-threatening injuries, what has not changed is the vastly disproportionate legitimacy of the two sides. In other words, even if Israeli violence in the occupied territories was absolutely proportionate, even if it was exchanging only rifle bullet for rifle bullet or even stone for stone, the Israeli violence would be illegal because the military occupation that the violence is aimed at serving is itself illegal. And that's the part that we have not been hearing. Not only have we not been hearing even the results of this escalation in violence over the last weeks of the election crisis here at home, but we have not at all been hearing the other side of the political question about the nature of this occupation.
Phyllis, in terms of the negotiations that are being called this week, there are many assessments, pretty dim assessments, that this can work. But the idea that Ehud Barak, the Israeli prime minister, who will be standing for election in February, is desperate at this point to reach some kind of peace agreement, the pressure is on. What do you think may result from these talks? Anything?
Well, I'm afraid, Scott, that the prognosis is not very bright. I think, as you say, that the hopes are not being raised very high. I think at most there may be a resumption of a process which has been largely discredited, largely proved itself incapable of raising a serious set of possibilities, if you will, of what serious negotiations might lead to. There was speculation in the Los Angeles Times, for instance, that the new basis on which the talks might convene could include some kind of a compromise quid pro quo arrangement in which the Palestinians would accept some minimal level of Palestinian sovereignty over the Haram al-Sharif alone, the Temple Mount, the holy sites of East Jerusalem, in return for giving up, explicitly rejecting and giving up their right of return for the Palestinian refugees. That leaves out, of course, the whole question of sovereignty for the city of East Jerusalem. It treats it as if the 200,000 Palestinians who live there, among which are another 200,000 Israeli settlers in Arab East Jerusalem. Of course, West Jerusalem is not on anyone's agenda. But within East Jerusalem, there is no question, apparently, of sovereignty for the city, for the people who live there. There is only this question of control of the holy sites, as if Jerusalem was nothing but a holy site. The notion that that would be given up as well as the Palestinian right of return is a guarantee that those talks, if they were to be based on that, would fail. It's a guarantee of failure. Now, I would hope we have a new administration coming in. The administration that is entering does not have the same history as its predecessors in the unchallenged support for Israel. Colin Powell, even, despite his long history of pro-Israeli statements and the fact that he speaks Yiddish and has been a great favorite among not only the Jewish community in the U.S., but as well the pro-Israeli lobby, which is not at all the same thing, made a remark that indicated that he might see things in a slightly more balanced way when he spoke of the need for the U.S. to do everything possible to meet the needs of the Palestinians. That was a hopeful sign. But so far, we are not seeing any indication that new approaches might be launched, certainly not in this last 20 days or so of the Clinton administration. I think Clinton has not quite given up the idea that he could still pull a legacy rabbit out of the hat, if you will, on the Middle East and have something to leave behind, another great photo op, and perhaps he will get that. He will get the form. The problem is the substance will not be behind it. So I'm afraid that there's not very much that we can look forward to from this current round of talks.
That was Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. The U.S. Supreme Court's narrow 5-4 decision that stopped the counting of votes in Florida also handed the presidency to George W. Bush. With the court divided along much the same ideological lines as the rest of the country, media commentators and many politicians, including Vice President Al Gore, were quick to call for reconciliation and bipartisanship. But the man taking the oath of office in January will only be the fourth president in U.S. history to achieve power by winning the colonial-era Electoral College while losing the national popular vote. With absentee ballots now nearly tabulated around the country, press reports estimate that Al Gore beat Mr. Bush by more than 500,000 votes. Meanwhile, news organizations are preparing to count the votes in Florida that the U.S. Supreme Court effectively suppressed, and the nation may soon know which candidate was the actual victor in that critical state. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Ratner, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who looks at the lasting impact of the 5-week post-election dispute.
It's one of the most appalling things I've ever seen, and I lived through the Nixon years. I lived through the Iran-Contra gate. I lived through Reagan taking office and changing the entire structure of both the taxes and civil liberties in this country. And this was one of the most appalling stolen elections, you know, I've ever seen. So we first have the black votes. Then we have a state that's essentially run like a plantation in terms of the Republicans. You got a governor who's the brother. You got the Secretary of State who's, you know, not only a Bush co-campaign manager, but an elector for George Bush as well. And she's the one who's certifying the vote, deciding what votes are valid and what votes aren't valid, and, of course, deciding it in favor of George Bush. So you have essentially a plantation state. And then you even have when it thought that they might not win that way, they were having read it out of the Florida State Legislature, you know, pass a law that made the Bush elect, that gave a new slate of Bush electors. And then, of course, you have the votes that were the actual ones that were contested by Gore, which this whole business of the, you know, how far they were poked through and the Chads and all that. In summary, you basically saw in Florida an essentially stolen election, even without the Supreme Court. I mean, the Florida Supreme Court finally would have done the right thing, but they didn't get the chance.
Michael Ratner, when it comes to the mechanics of voting and the obvious flaws we saw in Florida, it looks like the Congress bipartisan effort will come forth. We're going to see money for new technology, new voting machines, and so forth. But what are some of the other electoral reforms that you'd like to see focused on at this moment in history where everybody's sort of eyes are wide open, taking in all the questionable activity on the part of a whole host of institutions in this country that had pretty much gotten a pass before?
Well, I think it's a great thing in that sense that it really exposed the American system of voting as having a lot of, flaws would be the most limited way you could say it, but, you know, you could almost say a corrupt system. So new voting machines may be helpful, but there's obviously 100 other ways. Polling places don't open on time in black communities. Blacks need more identification. A whole series of ways in which voting is skewed. But of course, at bottom, is the campaign finance reform is a crucial part of whatever's going to go on. Let's face it, big money still rules our elections. And until that ends, we're not going to really have a system in which people's votes really count. Only really the money is going to count. And so I think, as much as I want to see new voting machines, what I want to see is really federal financing of elections where there's no such thing as the hard money limits are there, but that there should be the soft money, which is just another way of saying any corporation or any person can give tens of thousands of dollars, shouldn't be there either. A third area, after we got voting machines, we got campaign finance reform, is obviously the public debates. Look at a guy like Ralph Nader, who was excluded from the public debates by this so-called phony private corporation. That been a state corporation, they couldn't, state entity, they couldn't have done it. So they set up some, dummy thing they call private, which then says, oh, we're private, we don't have to let Ralph Nader into the debates. So the American people are not getting real debates on the issue. Sure, there's differences between Bush and Gore, but to not have a real debate on the more fundamental issues that Ralph Nader could have brought, did bring to it, but wasn't allowed to speak to nationally, it's just a constitutional outrage in my view.
Just a final question, Michael, on the incoming Bush administration, what do you think is ahead? Certainly it's the most disputed election in recent U.S. history, only the fourth time a candidate has gained the office of the presidency, not winning the popular vote. Does the Bush agenda survive this thing? What I've been hearing echoing in the press and among politicians over the last several days are these, very strained calls for reconciliation and unity and bipartisanship. What do you think we're going to see?
Well, that's all junk. I don't think there should be particularly bipartisanship or unity. First, the election was stolen. Secondly, I would hope the Democrats don't agree with some of Mr. Bush's ideas for, across-the-board tax cuts, the end of the death tax, his incredible, wonderful imposition of the death penalty, and a lot of other things the guy stands for. So I would hope there's not bipartisanship. I would hope what the Democrats do is simply fight the guy every inch of the way and make any policy direction that he would take almost impossible to go forward with. Unfortunately, that may not be the case, and frequently the Democrats and Republicans wind up doing a similar amount of damage. But I'm hopeful that they may not in this case because he does have so little legitimacy. I also think he's probably not really the president. It looks to me like, and even the Times had it one day on the front page, about Cheney's power. And if you look at the people around him, they're people from his father's administration, a lot of them. So I think that on a certain level, we're going to be getting a lot of people in there that are antithetical to what I think is necessary to create a better America. And that's very, very unfortunate.
That was Michael Ratner, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center by calling them at area code 212-614-6464 or visit his website at www.mratner.com. With fanfare usually reserved for celebrities and rock stars, General Colin Powell burst onto the political stage as the nation's first African-American chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and a central figure in some of America's most recent military interventions. Just days after the five-week election dispute was settled by a Supreme Court-ordered halt to the vote count, President-elect George W. Bush nominated Powell for Secretary of State. In a career stretching back to the Vietnam era, the retired four-star general oversaw U.S. combat missions in both Panama and the Persian Gulf War. During the Reagan administration, where he served as National Security Advisor, Powell also played a peripheral role in the Iran-Contra scandal when his sworn testimony was challenged for inconsistencies by Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh. In a speech accepting his nomination, Powell promised re-energized sanctions against his old nemesis Iraq and pledged to build an anti-ballistic missile defense system opposed by Russia and many U.S. allies. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Perry, award-winning investigative journalist who assesses General Colin Powell's career and forecasts the assistance Bush will need in formulating his administration's foreign policy initiatives.
Powell is an interesting figure because he has been such an icon to so many. He's received adulation from the press and from a large parts of the American population. So he's never been looked at very objectively, at least not over the last decade or so. But by reading carefully not just the documents that came out during Iran-Contra, but his own memoirs and the memoirs of people like General Schwarzkopf, one sees a very different role being played by Colin Powell than you might imagine. And also going back to his Vietnam era, he was one of the early advisors serving in Vietnam in the 62-63 time frame. And many of those advisors, seeing the way the war was being conducted, the destruction of villages and the concentration of the Vietnamese population in various strategic hamlets, that many of these advisors came back and said, this is not working and this is a disaster. Powell was one of the few of those early advisors who didn't protest. And it became basically a way he established his career path. And I think that continued through the My Lai massacre, where he was assigned to the Marikal Division and had a role in the early investigation of the My Lai massacre, which he proceeded to effectively cover up until it was later exposed. But he always was able to play that the company man position and move ahead. And that goes through Iran-Contra, right up through the Persian Gulf War. And to an extent, it continues to today, because many African Americans were outraged at what was happening in Florida. They were outraged at especially the 14th Amendment, the equal protection statutes, which were designed to stop discrimination and against minorities and particularly against African Americans. These principles were now being employed by the Bush campaign to shut down the counting of votes in heavily African American communities. And again, Colin Powell was present as these decisions were being made, and as far as we know from the public record, he did nothing to dissuade Governor Bush from pursuing that course.
Robert Perry, if you would, just review for our listeners briefly the U.S. invasion of Panama, which many international human rights organizations saw as a blatant violation of some very well-recognized tenets of international law.
The basic story of the Panama invasion was that the United States chose to violate international law to oust Noriega from power. Many civilians were killed around Noriega's headquarters. The actual number has always been a matter of secrecy. Many of the bodies were simply buried in mass graves. Some human rights groups claimed they were in the thousands. The official count was in the hundreds. And there was a good deal of criticism of the human rights groups for allegedly exaggerating the numbers. But the numbers were never determined, and basically the U.S. just moved past it. Noriega was brought up for trial, and even though at the trial there was more evidence about his involvement with the Contras and their involvement with cocaine trafficking, there was that period of the Reagan-Bush era where we simply didn't get to the bottom of things.
Well, a final question for you, Robert Perry. In looking at George W. Bush and his incoming administration, the folks we know who will be part of that administration thus far, what are some of your concerns about where these guys may take the country in the next 4 years?
Well, you know, I think there is a serious question about what kind of policies President-elect Bush will follow. I'm not sure he understands the world very well. One thing that was not well noticed during the campaign, which I think was an important question, was the fact that he has never really traveled much. He's never really traveled to Europe, for instance. He's never been to London or Paris or Moscow or Berlin. And that may strike people as odd, considering that he was fairly wealthy and well-connected, and his father certainly was well-traveled. It shows sort of a lack of curiosity, almost. But that gets to this question of, will he be able to understand the world in any kind of subtle way? And there will be very tough questions, certainly in the subcontinent of Africa, where Pakistan and India are developing nuclear weapons. In China, where there's great concern about possibility of the U.S. pushing ahead on the Star Wars missile defense system. And domestic policy, I'm not sure he understands the problems of the environment very, very well. So I think those are the kinds of issues that he'll have to show that he can rise to the occasion, or at least have advisors who can not just advise him, but almost tell him what to do. You know, usually presidents have some world experience that lets them make judgments when advisors give conflicting advice. We're facing a different kind of situation here. So I think most Americans would be surprised to hear that the man they elected, or the man that who's, whether they elected him or not, is going to be taking the White House, really doesn't know much about the world where the United States must play a very important role. And that should keep some people up at night. It should be something of great concern. But we're off in that direction, whether we like it or not.
That was Robert Perry, award-winning investigative journalist and editor of Consortium News. Contact the online publication by visiting their website at www.consortiumnews.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Archibald Curry, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.